And welcome
Love
to another
Radio.
And welcome to another Norm at Night. Hold on a second. I got a caller already. Welcome. You're on with Norm. Just hold on for a second, and I'll be right back with you. But welcome to another Norm at Night, coming to you live right here from Bowie, Maryland, practically on the banks of the Potomac. I had the great pleasure last night of being engaged in a discussion on some political issues with some first published, well, they were called political essays. I thought they were a little short to be called essays. But nevertheless, they caused some real, some real thinking on my part. I thought they were extraordinarily well argued, short as they may have been. But actually, short makes it good for tonight's show. With the author's permission, who, though we may hear from him tonight, will remain anonymous at his request. But the first issue with Norm at Night, or the first essay, I'm going to read it to you. And then I hope that some of you will call in so that we might discuss it. It's entitled Greed, and it reads as follows. Sharks do not overfeed. If a shark in the wild or in captivity has fed recently enough not to be hungry now, he won't attack a human swimming nearby. If sharks did, as a matter of course, overfeed, that is, eat more than they needed to keep healthy, they'd go extinct because their gluttony would upset the balance between them and their prey. Greed is like gluttony. It's an imbalance between what is needed to remain healthy and wanting more of it than need requires. A simple way to express this is that greed and gluttony and all the classical seven deadly sins is an imbalance between needs and wants. It might be said that every human is greedy. Everyone wants an adequate income to survive, to be healthy, to be prosperous, to keep up with the Joneses and to own a car, a few TVs, and the latest techno gimmick. But the action of most humans do not show a devotion to do anything and everything possible to maximize income or wealth beyond need or a little beyond need. Most humans would rather do other stuff than work harder and harder to earn more and more. A greedy person is wedded, addicted to more at whatever cost. Everyone is not greedy. Most humans are not greedy at all. There are accidental billionaires, men who were committed to an activity the side effect of which was to gain great wealth. Like Bill Gates, like Michael Vick, like Will Smith and Beyonce. But greedy people have the accumulation of wealth as the object of their efforts, that it is an insatiable urge, that there is no enough, there is only more. Just because you eat when you're hungry does not make you a glutton. Just because you work when you need money does not make you greedy. Greed and gluttony and the other five may or may not be deadly sins, but they are surely an imbalance between needs and wants, and they are addictions and obsessions, and they are unhealthy. And they cost all of us. The rest of us are victims of the excesses of the greedy and the gluttonous, and we end up cleaning up after the messes that they make. a system that is designed to benefit the unhealthy few among us is an unhealthy system. The unhealthy boast that their way is the healthy way. Before you know it, more and more healthy people start to copy them, acting unhealthy. And the world gets sicker because the planet does not know the difference between wants and needs. The planet wants what it needs, no more, no less. You have all seen photos of a clear-cut forest, a mountaintop removed, a gigantic oil spill, and a rainforest being developed. You know sick when you see it. We live in a sick system. What can you do about it? For starters, stop admiring people who are sick. Stop admiring the auction or the action that benefits the few and the unhealthy at the cost to the rest of us. That's the first essay. So what do you think about that? 347-945-6713 is the answer. Okay, 646, you're on with Norm at Night. Welcome.
Hello, Norm.
How are you doing?
Okay. Author here. For the sake of full disclosure. And I'm getting an echo, but never mind.
Well, here, it depends where I sit so that I don't hear my own speaker.
In any event, I wrote the essay. I think because the whole idea of greed has been more and more accepted lately. I mean, there are still folks who blame greed for all sorts of nasty stuff, but there are those who are starting to defend the word as though the word itself is defensible. The word starts out being one of the seven deadly sins, and it's sort of indefensible as long as we know what it is and what it isn't. And the whole notion of wanting to keep up with the Joneses, well, that's not greedy. That's not out of bounds. That's wanting a little bit more than need. And it doesn't require that you devote your life to more and more and more and more. It's just having a job that's good enough, that allows you some leisure, that allows you a second car, that allows you to buy a new iPhone every few years. And you can hardly put that in the same class as well, I don't know, let's name a name, Donald Trump. I don't know. You know, I don't know in particular whether anybody falls under the heading of greedy, but there are certainly people who are in the financial world whose entire life seems to be about this. Again, is a Trumpism. The person who wins is the person who dies with the most toys, as though it's a large no stakes, no limit poker game, where only one person ends up walking away with anything. Everybody else loses, and that seems to be okay with a lot of people. And I suspect that the folks for whom it's starting to be okay to be greedy have to really look at what it is we're talking about. I mean, admiring these people is a real mistake. It upends every religious value. It upends every philosophical value. It upends common sense. But hey, we're American. We can do what we want. And part of that want is to go astray and to admire these people when what's called the Great Recession of 2008, the potential second depression, was brought about by people who, and that's all they did, was they juggled money in attempts to win ill-gotten bets, wagers. I mean, the financial sector has become a glorified gambling casino, the only problem being that in the final analysis, the taxpayers who weren't involved at all end up cleaning up the mess. Not just the taxpayers, but the people who have lost jobs due to the recklessness of these people for whom money is the only thing, is the measure of everything.
Well, is the echo gone now?
Yeah.
Okay,
yes,
good. I adjusted my audio a bit. My question is, people like the Koch brothers, are they greedy?
As I say, it's difficult to be really simple-minded about answering the question. The whole notion that I don't know, not knowing them personally, I don't know if they're objective in terms of the political monies that they spend, is to make sure that next year they'll make $12 billion more than they made this year. I don't have an answer to that. I have my suspicions, but that's all they are, is suspicions. And my suspicions are that it's not just, that it's probably not just about money, that they've probably created a worldview around what they're doing is okay. And part of what they're doing probably is okay, certainly if we forget about global warming for a moment and forget about the damage that fossil fuels do to the planet. If we forget about that, it's probably okay to want your company to succeed even more and more and more each year. I mean, that's ingrained in our capitalist culture. But sometimes there's a difference between a corporation with an identity that is spread over thousands upon thousands of people versus here's a corporation that is spread over two brothers. I mean, obviously they have I don't know, are they private or are they public? I don't even know the answer to that.
Well, if they are private, they have to have other shareholders.
Well, if they're private, they're still in charge, and they don't have to.
I only know about Maryland. In Maryland, you have to have five.
Okay. I don't know. My guess is probably yes, they would fall under that heading because God knows they have enough, and they could, if they wanted to, be following the lead of somebody like Bill Gates. And when I say following the lead of Bill Gates, all I'm talking about is the fact that having come to the realization that his net worth was over $50 billion, he decided to chuck Microsoft and become a philanthropist. Where can I use my money to do the most good?
Let's not give him too much credit. He did not chuck Microsoft. If he did, he'd be a zero.
I'm sorry, I missed that. Say that again.
He did not chuck Microsoft. His wealth is based on Microsoft. He just doesn't run it anymore.
Yeah, his wealth is based on Microsoft, but he could very easily have remained at the helm, and he chose to take his net worth, however it was obtained, and to use it for purposes that were not strictly putting more money in his pocket. I mean, that's the distinction between him and the Koch brothers. And Warren Buffett said, hey, we play bridge together, and it looks like you're doing a good job, so I think I'll do the same thing with my money. Buffett had never been thought of as a philanthropist before Gates. Gates put him on the track.
What's the difference between being money greedy and power greedy?
Power is a funny thing. Power invariably is a relationship between people, and it's power over. There's a sort of an automatic master-slave relationship there. In the case of a hedge fund manager who makes $12 billion or whatever it is, whatever he might make, there is no necessary master-slave relationship, at least nothing that's direct. It's just about an accumulation of a lot of the chips on the table. So there are differences.
Money allows you to wield power. A professional athlete,
yes,
for instance, has plenty of money, but they're not really very powerful. Somebody holds
power. Who or what is not very powerful?
Professional athletes. Some of them have tons of money.
Yeah.
And they're always seeking bigger contracts, but they don't have any power.
Well, but they do have power. They influence the lifestyle of other people who like to emulate them. But it's not the same as the kind of power that we're talking about when we say money versus power. That's again a master slave kind of relationship.
Well, the
in
fact
a democracy,
remains that. The owner of an NFL team, for instance, I want to stay away from the NBA right now. The owner of the team makes way more money than the players, who everybody thinks are, you know, multimillionaires.
Yeah.
But they have no power relative to the owner.
Right.
They may have
power during negotiation, but not necessarily power over, but they certainly, there's a balance that has to be met when an owner and a player negotiate.
Right.
You know,
well, the balance
the owner
is
doesn't,
the owner says, if I pay him X, do I make Y?
Sure.
And if the answer is no, they don't pay them.
Yeah, well.
And there have been very few athletes who've done anything after they've been an athlete.
That's their decision, though. It's not, I mean, an athlete who accumulates and doesn't lose money.
I think it's what they're able to do.
I don't think there's anything intrinsic about being an athlete that would. Well, Bill Bradley became a senator in New Jersey.
The exception proves the rule.
Well, okay, all right. It's not somebody who starts out as an athlete does not have it in their psyche greed is not in their psyche. Their psyche is, I'd love to play ball for a living. And I'm good enough so that I'll make a lot of money. But making a lot of money is not the end all. When you think about somebody leaving college and instantly going to Wall Street, it's different from somebody who becomes a fireman or a cop or a reporter or a journalist or an author or a teacher. Sorry?
Is it different than somebody who becomes a star quarterback?
Absolutely. Somebody who becomes a quarterback, that's what they want to do. And if we lived in a world where nobody got paid money for doing stuff, that person would still be doing that. People who become teachers, that's the direction they would go even in the socialist world. People who become doctors, it's very likely a good percentage of them would become doctors anyway. Lawyers is open to argument, but there's lots of professions where in a world where everyone got paid the same, people would still go down the same path. The only distinction may be finance, and finance of today, not necessarily the finance of 30 years ago.
Well, that's interesting.
The finance
you say that most teachers come from the bottom half of college graduating classes.
That's due to the fact that teachers in this country are treated with and I'm being nice, are treated with disdain.
Teachers
are not respected in this country. But that's Norm. You're saying the same thing as I am. You're saying it in terms of dollars and cents, and I'm saying it reflects society's values. It's the same thing. The very fact that a ball player, the player, we're not talking the owners, the very fact that a ball player can make a gazillion dollars and a teacher, even a teacher who publishes, even a college professor who becomes the author of a textbook that everybody uses, probably in his lifetime doesn't make what a star quarterback makes in a good year.
A Nobel Prize winner doesn't make
well,
it.
Well, a Nobel
his
Prize
winner,
what do they get? $1 million? And that's
well,
a one-shot
yeah.
deal?
And a
star quarterback?
Okay.
And a star quarterback or a good guard or center on an NBA team? I mean, that's $1 million is a fine. You know, that's a penalty for doing something bad for 5 days. So there's a huge difference. And I'm saying the athletes are much closer to being the teachers and the cops and the firemen than they are to being the people who go to work in finance, who are going to work to get into a big poker game where somebody else is giving them the money and they can play with it and take the money themselves, even if their own corporation goes.
So a kid who goes to UPenn, he's got 1,600 SATs, he goes to UPenn, he goes to the Wharton School of Business, and then he goes right to Wall Street. So you're telling he's just a poker player.
Sure, why not?
The
reason I don't want to be absolutist about this is because there probably are some really fine, decent people who do this. And it would be interesting to have a conversation with somebody like that to knock me off my certainties here, to knock my obvious prejudices that I've shown already in the first minutes,
Everybody, I don't know how many people are out there listening right now, but if you want to knock our anonymous author here off his pedestal, the number's 347-945-6713. Hey, I got a call coming in already. You better grab your pedestal. Here we go. Go ahead, you're out with Norm.
Hey, guy, how you doing tonight?
I'm doing pretty well, actually. Have you been listening to our discussion on grief?
I caught a bit of it, yeah.
You want to knock my guest off his pedestal? He thinks all the people going to Wall Street are scum. Maybe even people who live like you off your investments are scum.
Well, if it wasn't for people who provide capital, what else? What would you have? Joe Blow
well,
needs money.
You might have some equality.
Well, equality.
You might have real wealth instead of interest wealth, which is called
wealth. Real wealth. You're going to define that for me?
Yeah, sure.
What's real wealth?
Something you can hold, taste, and feel.
Oh, gold.
No. Not gold.
Gold.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You should watch Game of Thrones for a lesson on gold.
I've never seen an episode of Game of Thrones.
Save it for later. Well, there was a scene where this prince demanded his crown, and after they won a battle or whatever, and so he's trying to enlist all these barbarians to fight for him. And he kept insisting over and over he wanted his crown, he wanted his crown. He's a real spoiled brat. So finally the chief says, okay, we'll give you your crown.
Uh-huh.
And so they melt down all the gold and dump it over his head.
Yeah.
It was a horrible scene, but
It was a replay of the Midas story. Everything that you touch turns to gold, and Midas and his daughter gets turned to gold.
Your greed essay reminds me of the Gutelli the Golden Egg story.
Mm. Well, you know,
but
I
anyway,
think too.
I wanna change the subject, and I'm gonna read another essay from the collection.
Oh, geez.
I'm hoping, Norm,
you haven't let you haven't let this gentleman weigh in.
Hear the whole greed essay or discussion. So I was going to put another essay out there that we can all talk about together.
Why don't we let the gentleman talk about greed first?
Go ahead.
Well, let's put it this way: if you want to call greed a sin and bring in morality, I guess you can do that, but it's false. It's illogical.
My response to that is that greed begins as a sin. It's only recently that it's been put out by a subsection of humanity as okay, it's not a sin. But if you were listening to the discussion before, I distinguished between, and I'm the author of the piece that Norm read, distinguish between the kind of wants that most every human has versus the person for whom there is never enough.
Oh, right. Well, I think...
I distinguish... And gluttony doesn't mean feed me, I'm hungry. I'm sorry. If you have average weight, you're not a glutton. And there's nothing to discuss. If you're carrying 400 pounds extra, putting hormonal imbalances aside, you're clearly a glutton.
Mm-hmm.
If you're somebody who goes into a who out of college or out of business school goes into I'm going to go into the profession that will make me the most money, that's somebody who's greedy. Now, and yes, you could say, what's wrong with that? What's wrong with wanting to go into a profession where you make the most money? The answer is, there's no purpose to it. It's accepting the notion. It's accepting the notion that the dollar is the measure of all things. When somebody decides to become a doctor.
Yeah, but see, this is the thing. If you had mentioned Bill Gates and Warren Buffett, and if we want to go back to Carnegie and Ford and nearly all of the you know, they were either robber barons or they were philanthropists.
They were robber barons. They should have gone to jail, every one of them.
Okay, yeah. Well, yeah, with the president's changes, you know, chained with them. But look, you know, a lot of these people came to the same conclusion at the end. And they used their money for good. You know, I mean, they shared it.
Yeah, it wasn't even a deathbed conversion, though. It was merely, I can't take it with me, and I may as well gild my way into heaven as not. There were some of them, I believe Carnegie was among them, who believed that you should be giving away your money while you're still alive.
Mm-hmm.
What's that saying? Charity outweighs the most sins? Something like that.
And when I mention Gates and Buffett, I don't mention them as examples of greed at all.
Mm-hmm.
I mention them as examples of quite the reverse. I mean, in the case of Warren Buffett, he definitely went out of his way to make the most money possible, but it wasn't for the sake of money. It was for the sake of the game. And how do I say that? The reason I say that is because everyone knows that he may wear a $2,000 suit. He's made a joke about that. But he still lives, he doesn't live in a mansion. He doesn't drive the most expensive cars.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't look like a man for whom his wealth has anything to do with his conspicuous consumption. People make jokes about the fact that he goes into a restaurant and orders a Dairy Queen or a hamburger or whatever else. It's like,
this guy
is not impressed by money. He's it was a game for him.
$5,000. It's a game to go to military school in West Point, and now you're a lieutenant, and you want to work your way up. And how do you do that? You've got to have a war.
Well, not necessarily.
Well, if you want to make the ranks and be the hero and, you know, play the game. You got to
have a war
to play the game. That's what I'm saying.
People still go into the military in peacetime because that's the hand that they're dealt, and they still have the.
Well, if you're career military, if you're going
to
be in 20 to 30 years, you got a good chance of hitting a war, probably a couple.
Probably, well, because it's America and we like war.
Yes, exactly.
We do.
Yeah. Well, we don't, but some people do.
Well, the country does.
I don't know about that.
Well, enough of the country likes a war that when
maybe
one
a war that they don't have to fight in, but
of course.
You know,
I want to
go
back to Buffett a minute.
Okay.
Yeah, he talked about how he pays less taxes than his secretary, and that's not right, but he doesn't do anything about it.
Oh, yeah.
Well, there's not much that he can do about it. He's not a legislator.
Yes, there is. He can do all the things that he does to maintain the present system to change it.
Yeah. Well,
he can do it.
And what exactly would that look like, Norm? What exactly would he be doing to change the system? What's his action?
And the first thing he would do...
He's already a philanthropist. What's his action now in terms of redistributing his wealth?
Well, he would push for laws in the country that would redistribute his wealth for him. In other words, he would be taxed to death. The first thing he could do, instead of taking advantage of capital gains, is urge all the congressmen who his money and who he contributes to alter the capital gains. You know?
But
he
there's a thing
about
it,
but he
there's
doesn't
one thing
do
about
it.
Warren Buffett. Does he get involved in politics? Have you ever known him to do that?
No. No.
Exactly.
Directly?
Directly.
Absolutely. Is he involved in it every day? As soon as he said, you know, it's not right that my secretary pays more taxes than me, he was involved in politics.
But that was a statement, Norm. It's not.
He wasn't making that statement just to pass the time.
He didn't encourage, let's say, raise the capital gains tax by, you know, to 70% or something. He didn't say things like that. That would be political. But if he just says there's a discrepancy here, it's for someone else to solve.
I don't think between one version of a statement and another version of a statement you can say that one statement is political, another not. I think what he has said, when he talks about his secretary, that's political. And if he said raise the top marginal tax rate to 70%, that would be political. But it's not the same as the Koch brothers, who spend time and effort creating a structure that influences Washington, D.C., that influences Congress. Buffett doesn't do that at all.
Did Warren Buffett contribute a ton of money to the Obama campaign?
contributing money to the Obama campaign is one, A, I don't know the answer to that question.
Contributing money to
a campaign is not as activist as the Koch brothers have been. You brought the Koch brothers up long ago.
Their version
of activism is clearly of a different order than somebody who dumps a few million dollars into somebody's campaign.
You don't see
Warren Buffett saying, I'm just going to take $100,000 from all my capital gains and give the rest of it away. He doesn't do that. Bill Gates isn't just take the $50 billion and just give it away. He doesn't do that.
He very specifically earmarks it for causes that he believes in.
Yeah, and it's much better used and managed in his hands, certainly, than the government. I mean, give it to the government.
That could very well be.
You might as well just start a bonfire with it.
you guys living off the fat of interest, you know. I want to go to this next essay, and it's my show, and I'm doing it.
Go ahead. Go for it.
Because this, I can't decide. I am going to do women in the workforce.
Uh-oh.
That was the title.
Uh-oh.
This essay starts out in a real interesting way.
Now you'll find out if you have any women listeners.
Well, I hope so. I want all you feminists out there to get those dialing fingers ready. Now, the author of this article, Women in the Workplace, in the interest of full disclosure, I am a man. I am also a feminist. What I mean by feminist may not be the same as what you mean. So here is what I mean. I support 100% equality of women in the law. There ought to be no discrimination according to sex anywhere in the law, except in areas where there are clear biological differences, like the ability to conceive and bear a child. If matters such as these, I believe, the woman, not the law, not the man, should have 100% legal control of decisions regarding conceiving and bearing and delivery or abortion of the fetus child that she carries. I do not believe that men and women are the same. I believe that women are on average smarter than men and have superior self-discipline. More women than men enter medical school these days, and the same for law school. Many more women than men enter college these days. I suspect, but do not know, that more graduate too. I believe that on the average, women are shorter and lighter than men, less strong than men, and less aggressive than men. I believe, nonetheless, that women ought to have the same right to serve in the military. But I am agnostic, but I'd be easily swayed, about their serving on the front lines of an infantry unit. Maybe carrying a bazooka? No, that was an addition on my part. I believe that women ought to have the same access to good or bad jobs, and I believe that for the most part, they do in the USA. They may not have the same access to promotion to upper management, but they ought to, and they will soon enough. Having said all that, consider 50 years ago, the average American family had one breadwinner, typically the man, with a steady and secure job, owned a house with the help of bank-supplied mortgage, put away savings every month, sent Johnny and sometimes Jill to college, and even paid off their family's mortgage. Today and recently, the average American family has two breadwinners, if they're lucky, is less secure in their jobs, are less likely to own a home than rent an apartment, more likely to add monthly to their credit card debt, and are as likely to face foreclosure as ever to pay off the mortgage. While it is clear to me that the primary reason for this real national economic decline is tax policies that have allowed a small number of Americans to become super wealthy at the expense of everyone else, it is nearly as clear that women's expanding access to the workforce has contributed substantially also. Start those phones dialing, feminists. The law of supply and demand decides prices in a free market. A greater supply of an item, the lower its price. This is true of labor, too. The larger the pool of labor, the lower will be labor's average wage. The large-scale entry of women into the labor force nearly doubled the size of the labor force in the last few generations. Emphasis the authors. The unintended consequence of depressing the average price of labor or the average wage. If all women were to stay at home, men would earn much higher wages than they do today. This is an economic reality. Whether they would earn as much as two breadwinners do today is unknowable. It is equally true that if all men were just to stay at home, women would earn much higher wages than they do today. I'm not saying that a woman's place is in the home or the kitchen. If I were a woman, I'd be highly educated, and I'd be working at a great job. I'm not suggesting any woman should stop working just because, in the aggregate, their working depresses the wages of men. This line of thinking also says that for the sake of health of the labor market, people should have small families. And countries with a shrinking population do not wage war, while those with an expanding population will inevitably find themselves in need of Lieberstrom and will provoke a war. China is reining in her population. Not smart if she wants to start a war. This short essay is not good news for many people. That does not make it less true. What can we do? What should we do? I don't know. I really don't know. Think about it. So what should we do, 916?
Oh. Well, it's an issue I haven't dealt with in a very long time.
Well, you're a guy. You've never dealt with it.
Yeah, well, I have had, you know, I was a supervisor in a at a newspaper and had women employees, in fact, majority female employees. And the one thing I learned was that there's a level of accommodation that has to be there. This has to do daycare, children, nursing in the break room, you name it. Anything, you know, special, different, but can be accommodated. And I didn't have a real problem with that. In fact, I made a point of making sure everybody knew that you can do things, just ask and we'll work it out, you know. So you know, I realize that there the differences are there, and we adjust to them. And I think it's important, and it's absolutely vital given the nature of the family today. I don't know, growing up in a family today with both parents working and I don't know, that it what I'm seeing is something very distant and isolated. The emotional bonding is, you know, kind of weak. And so I don't know, I'm not saying the workplace should be, you know, we aren't social workers, although sometimes that happens, but you know, I just did what I could, you know, to try to make it as comfortable for everyone involved. And the other is, of course, I work for a very liberal company where many women had all the top management positions. You know, they were equally represented everywhere.
About the only editor, a man or a woman?
At that time, the publisher, the publisher was female. The advertising director was female. There were a number, you know, it varied. But even to the corporate level, that's where it was a little dicey at the corporate level. But now that has broken down some too. There are more women on the board of directors than there were. So anyway, in fact, let me think now. Yeah, I would say predominantly at the main newspaper. I think there are more women in the top positions than men at this time. Yeah. So,
but
and
yet they were still paying the men more?
No, of course not. They'd never get away with that.
Well, then how come women only make 77 cents for every dollar a man makes?
I really doubt that number.
And what do you base that doubt on?
Well, here's one factor. If I think women, especially women who, you know, decide to have children, I think they go in and out of the workforce at various times. They may take a year off here or whatever, and as a result, I don't think they have the tenure. That would be for education, but. They haven't been in a position long enough to get consistent raises. So when they're starting in a new job, they're starting, you know, at a lower wage again, you know. So that's just my feeling on there.
I think that if it's true.
Well, that would happen even if you were a man. If I'm in and out of the workplace and I have an inconsistent work history...
Well, all those babies get fathers.
I could be taking time off for whatever reason. I mean, that really doesn't matter. We're just saying, as an employee, you're not going to bring the same kind of, you know, consistent work record or work history.
My wife, with three kids, she's been at the same company for almost 40 years.
Well, that's great, you know. What I'm saying is people do take a year off, you know, sometimes it's a sabbatical, sometimes it's to have a child, sometimes it's to, we had people take time off to make a baby, not...
Okay, so if I'm an employer, why should I hire somebody that may do that?
Yeah, well... That is a consideration. I don't know what protections are in place there.
If you're a very small employer, I don't think any would-be employee has any protections.
And
I don't think it'll be appropriate for
right. And see, and regardless of gender, if you do have, let's say, an inconsistent work history, that alone is probably, that could be a reason, you know, compared to another employee for not hiring you. Yeah, I mean, that that is a possibility. So, you know.
Hey,
I mean,
all you
also,
listeners, hold on 1 second. All you listeners out there, if you want to join in this discussion, it's really fun. It's 347-945-6713. The anonymous political author, my buddy from the West Coast, and me. We'd love to have you join us. This is the Norm and Night Show.
Norm,
go ahead.
Norm, do you have somebody coming in?
No, I don't have anybody right now.
Okay, let me butt in here. We've been talking ever since you finished reading the essay. You've been talking about women as somehow second-class employees, which may or may not be an interesting subject, but it wasn't the subject of my essay at all. My essay merely was looking at an historical fact, which is that somewhere in the 1940s and the 1950s, women started flooding the marketplace in terms of jobs. Prior to World War II, the families consisted, as I said at the beginning of the essay, of a masculine breadwinner and a stay-at-home mom. And that was a lifestyle that was common then. The lifestyle that's common today is two breadwinners, as I say, if they're lucky, and yet the lifestyle somehow is not quite as well to do, and that the reason for that is with there being such a large supply of labor due to the fact that women commonly work, labor has, as an unintended consequence, undercut its own average wages. And I wasn't suggesting that women shouldn't do this. I'm just suggesting that I wasn't suggesting anything. I was merely remarking, observing something with an unintended consequence, which is one of my favorite notions that I play with, is unintended consequences. Women entering the workplace, which certainly is a positive thing in terms of the equality for women to get into and to compete with men, but the unintended consequence of which is that it undercuts the average wage for everybody, since there are so many women competing. The more people you have competing in a given game, good old supply and demand insists upon its role of saying, oh, yeah, we have 75 people looking for this job. I guess I can reduce the wages of this job until there's only 5 people looking for the job, not 75.
I'm just listening.
And as I say, with no suggested solution, not even suggesting it's a problem. It's just an unintended consequence of something that was looked all good. It hasn't turned out all good.
Yeah, but I don't think it's that simple.
The whole thing that I just discussed is not simple.
That's right. I mean,
yeah, well,
a lot of what changed, you know, the women had to go to work in the factories because the men were all off fighting the war.
That's right. Rosie the Riveter.
It was the first total modern war the country ever engaged in. And we had a massive military-industrial complex ever since.
Yep.
It never got small again.
Yeah, that's the complex that Eisenhower warned us about, but it's also the one he created. But
well, not really. He didn't create it, and it was necessary at the time.
Well, he helped it along. I mean,
it was necessary at the time. I don't think there's
Yeah,
a lot
but,
of people
you know,
are going to argue over
remember,
we shouldn't have gotten involved
you know,
in that
to,
war.
Oh, World
remember,
War II.
Back
yeah, that's
to what,
you know.
Back
I'm,
to what we were talking about earlier.
Yeah, yeah.
Dwight Eisenhower was a lieutenant colonel in 1940. That's how fast and how what a war does to promotion.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, he also proved his mettle. There are very few military people, recent military people whose military reputation remains unstained, and Dwight Eisenhower is among the few.
He didn't win any big battles.
Sorry?
He didn't win any big battles.
I didn't get that again.
He said he didn't win
any
big battles. Would you say that he won the Normandy invasion?
The Normandy invasion...
He was the leader of the Allies. I don't think we have to worry about leading a charge.
What he was very good at was keeping everybody talking to each other.
Well, and maybe that was as important as anything else.
The Normandy invasion was not
well, he planned it,
necessary
he didn't lead it.
To win the Second World War. The
Neither
Federal
were
World,
two bombs dropped on Japan necessary. I don't think we want to slice and dice World War II, do we?
Why not?
No. You need another couple of shows for that, dude.
Yeah.
Oh. Well, anyway, today we only have another minute, 30 seconds.
Oh, my
so
God. Time flies when you're having
first
fun,
thing
huh?
First thing I want to do is thank my political office for coming. Thank him for having the conversations we've had leading to this show, and I hope he's going to be coming back. I mean, we got four more essays. He only got through two of them.
Well,
we can take it to next week. But,
that sounds good. You should put a
military
link.
Commander Zhukov was much better than Eisenhower. As a politician, Dwight was a genius.
Yeah. Well, Zhukov also knew if he lost anything, he was a dead man. So, you know.
Who is this we're talking about? I missed
the Russian commander, Marshal Zhukov.
Zhukov of
Russia. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
No,
if you were a general under Stalin, it was like, you know, you win or you lose.
Yeah, well,
if you're
a general under Stalin, you've done the right things to get there and not be.
He was very lucky not
away.
To be a general officer during the 30s.
Yeah, that's true.
But anyway, we're at the end of the road. Thanks for coming on, Carl, and we will see you all next week. My cat's screaming to go outside, and I got 13 seconds left. It was a great evening on Norm at Night. Thanks for coming,
yeah.
guys, and I'll see you next week.
Hey, Norm, if you can post the... Is
what?
There a link you can post to the essays?
Yes, I'll get them up, and I'll let everybody know.
Yeah, put it on your Facebook
or
your blog, you know.
I'll put them on a blog somewhere. Is that all right?
Sounds good, yeah.
Is that all right, 646?
Sure.
Okay, well, and thanks a lot, and I'll say now, actually, we're recording. We're not live right now. But all I can say is the first night of nonfiction at the Writers Group was a smashing success. Thank you for coming aboard. Anyway,
okay.
I'll
thanks,
see you
Norm.
Guys next week.
See nice ya. Talking to both of you.
Likewise.
Bye-bye.
Anyway.
Talking about
all
what?
Right.
Yeah, we'll talk about the war. I love to talk about the war. But Norm is out of here.
Okay, take care, man.
I
good night.
Go crazy. I got to let her out. Good night.
Well, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.